This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. U.S. President Joe Biden said on Tuesday the Supreme Court will not decide until June a pandemic-era order allowing U.S. officials to rapidly expel migrants caught at the U.S.-Mexico border. Earlier Tuesday, the Supreme Court left in place the order known as Title 42.
And in the meantime, we have to enforce it. But I think it's overdue.
Biden speaking to White House reporters briefly before leaving for a vacation on the Caribbean island St. Croix. Aid group the International Rescue Committee said in a statement that Title 42 had been used to justify nearly 2.5 million expulsions since March 2020 and argued that U.S. border policies had caused significant strain throughout the region, making migration routes deadlier. Thousands of Western New Yorkers were digging out from under 4 feet of snow dumped during a deadly Christmas blizzard. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
New York State's second largest city of Buffalo was ground zero for what the governor has called an epic once-in-a-lifetime weather disaster. And the region is not yet in the clear.
Please, you heard the mayor beg. I'm begging. Stay home.
Erie County's chief executive, Mark Poloncarz, on Tuesday said the roads are treacherous and the driving ban was still in effect for the city of Buffalo. Some motorists ignored the ban, but personnel are on the way to help enforce it and help clear the roads of snow.
Oslo-based group Iran Human Rights said Tuesday at least 100 Iranians arrested in more than 100 days of nationwide protest face charges punishable by death. Protests have gripped Iran since the September 16th death in custody of Iranian Kurdish Mahsa Amini. This is VOA News. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has presented unspecified goals to further bolster his military power next year at a meeting of the nation's political officials. Kim's comments, reported by state media Wednesday, indicate he'll continue provocative weapons tests after a record run of missile launches this year. Some observers say the new goals could be related to Kim's push to expand his nuclear arsenal and introduce a spate of high-tech weapon systems, such as multi-warhead missiles, a spy satellite, and advanced drones. Israel's parliament passed controversial legislation Tuesday, paving the way for the return of veteran conservative Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister. VOA's Steve Karish reports.
Netanyahu will lead what analysts have said will be the most right-wing government in Israel's history. The legislation allows anyone convicted of offenses but not given a custodial sentence to serve as a minister. Before the law was passed, there had been uncertainty over whether Aryeh Deri, a key ally from the ultra-Orthodox Shas party, would be able to serve, as he had previously pled guilty to tax offenses. Steve Karish, VOA News, Washington.
Kosovo's interior minister has accused Serbia, under the influence of Russia, of aiming to destabilize Kosovo by supporting members of the country's ethnic Serb minority in weeks of protest and violence. Reuters correspondent Matthew Larotonda reports.
Kosovo has a small ethnic Serb minority. Some members have been blockading roads there since December 10th and exchanged gunfire with police. Late on Monday night, Serbia, which is allied to Russia, also announced that it was putting its army on its highest level of alert, saying that it fears Kosovo authorities are preparing to attack the ethnic Serbs. Serbia's defense minister denies Kosovo's claims and says it wants to protect the minority.
The UN Security Council on Tuesday called on the Taliban to reverse policies targeting women and girls in Afghanistan, expressing alarm at the quote-unquote increasing erosion of human rights in the country. In the latest blow to women's rights in Afghanistan since the Taliban reclaimed power last year, on Saturday the hardline Islamist rulers banned women from working in non-governmental organizations, sparking international outcry. Find more on these stories on our website, voanews.com, or for the latest news, follow us on the VOA mobile app. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Wednesday, December 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Chinese hospitals are buckling under the pressure of a massive COVID outbreak.
This is a direct result of not really coming up with a policy that respects the biology of the virus, teaching people harm reduction principles, and using the most potent Western-based vaccines.
And heavy fighting continues in an eastern Ukrainian town as Moscow issues another threat to Kyiv.
Sergei Lavrov said Ukraine must remove any military threat to Russia. Otherwise, he said, the Russian army will solve the issue.
And at least 10 people are killed in Burkina Faso when a bus hits a landmine. We'll have these stories and more next. Chinese medical staff are outnumbered and working sick as the country's healthcare system is struggling to keep up with thousands of COVID cases. China's hospitals had already been overcrowded and understaffed before the recent COVID outbreak, but now one hospital worker is often doing the work of five people. I asked Dr. Amash Adalja of the Johns Hopkins Center for Global Health and an infectious disease physician with Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health why this is happening now in China.
COVID is hitting China so hard right now because they have unique circumstances. They have a population that does not have much in the way of strong immunity to this virus. While many Chinese are vaccinated, many of the high-risk groups that are at risk for severe disease are not boosted, and the vaccine that the Chinese have access to is not very potent. This is a direct result of not really coming up with a policy that respects the biology of the virus, teaching people harm reduction principles, and using the most potent Western-based vaccines. What's going on in China is not surprising.
Many hospitals in China are not bothering to require staff to test before their shifts. And Dr. Ajalja says that's not surprising either.
China is basically in a situation of crisis standards of care, and therefore it's not unusual for them to suspend testing of healthcare workers because they just cannot cope. It's important to recognize that this was predictable, foreseeable, and is a direct result of the prior policies that they had in place.
Adalja says during the last 2+ years during the COVID epidemic, it would have made sense for China to vaccinate their high-risk population with more high-potency vaccines and to build their ICU capacity.
China's healthcare system is very fragmented, with more capacity in the bigger cities, but less in rural areas. Throughout the time that they stuck to this zero COVID policy, they basically abdicated the response and did not take the necessary actions that would have given their country resiliency. It was one of the biggest failures that we've seen with COVID-19.
Looking at China's COVID policy in hindsight, Adalja says it's obvious that the country did not recognize the biology of a virus that could not be eradicated or eliminated. He says the government failed to take actions that would have allowed the population the ability to live with the virus for the rest of their lives. 3 years ago, scientists in Wuhan, China, first reported infections from a novel coronavirus. Since then, the world has developed and delivered 13 billion shots against COVID-19. It is an unprecedented achievement, but it has been tarnished by unequal access. The global program aimed at improving vaccine equity has announced it will narrow its focus to the poorest countries. VOA's Steve Barragona has a look at the global COVID vaccine drive as a pandemic blamed for more than 6.5 million deaths enters its fourth year.
February 24th, 2021, delivery of COVID-19 vaccines arrives in Ghana, striking a blow for vaccine equity. UNICEF representative Anne Claire Dufay was there to greet them.
We're really happy because they're going to benefit a large number of beneficiaries in Ghana. Ghana is the first country to receive the COVAX vaccines.
The UN-backed COVAX program aimed to help low- and middle-income countries get access to COVID vaccines after rich countries had locked down most of the early supplies. The program struggled to compete for limited doses. After nearly 2 billion shots delivered, COVAX is narrowing its scope to serve the poorest countries. That's in part because 2 years later, there are plenty of shots available. Not everyone is getting them, however, says Duke University global health professor Krishna Udaikumar.
The inequities really are stark and continued. In Africa, only 25% of the population of the entire continent is fully vaccinated, compared with more than 75% in places like South America.
Supply is not the biggest problem anymore. Demand is. People in lower-income countries are not lining up for COVID shots, says Center for Global Development health expert Janine Madan Keller.
This lack of demand is really a concerning trend we're seeing. The reasons behind low demand, I'd say, are quite complex and multifaceted.
Misinformation about the vaccines is rampant. Trust in governments providing the shots is low. And many people in lower-income countries don't see COVID as much of a threat. Plus, the vaccines took too long to arrive, Uday Kumar says.
While there was demand, it was unmet. So it's reasonable now that we're seeing more hesitancy because we missed the time when everybody was ready to accept and take vaccines.
Much of the delay was because vaccine manufacturing is concentrated in a few, mostly wealthier nations. Poorer nations were left hoping for handouts, says Brown University Pandemic Center Director Jennifer Nuzzo.
I think we have to figure out how to make these vaccines in a much more distributed way than we did before, so we aren't just relying on donations. It's clear donations do not work because when faced with a crisis, countries will always choose to prioritize their own populations.
Efforts are underway to build more vaccine factories in Africa, but building them is just the start. How to keep them in business in the long run is another question, Keller says.
Who's going to buy these vaccines? Or what vaccines make sense, both from an economic but also from a health perspective, for these manufacturers to produce? Where will the money to pay for them come from?
The African Union faces these questions as it aims to manufacture 60% of its routine vaccines on the continent by 2040. The challenge is to build a sustainable vaccine industry that can handle both regular vaccines and the inevitable next pandemic. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Heavy fighting continues in the eastern Ukrainian town of Krimina, according to a Ukrainian official, as Russia brings in large numbers of troops to bolster its forces in the region. Russian President Vladimir Putin's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has warned that Ukraine must fulfill Moscow's proposals regarding its so-called new territories, that's four occupied regions of Ukraine, or the Russian military would take action. Associated Press reporter Karen Chamas has more.
Russia's foreign minister has warned that Ukraine must demilitarize, claiming Kiev and the West were responsible for fueling the war that started with Moscow's invasion. Sergei Lavrov said Ukraine must remove any military threat to Russia. Otherwise, he said, the Russian army will solve the issue. He also insisted Ukraine and the West were responsible for the 10-month war, which has killed tens of thousands of people and displaced millions. Lavrov reiterated that the West was feeding the war in Ukraine to weaken Russia and said that it was up to Kiev and Washington how long the conflict will last. In an apparent reaction, Ukrainian presidential adviser Mykhailo Podolyak tweeted that Russia needs to face the reality. I'm Karen Chamas.
The UN Security Council on Tuesday called for the full, equal, and meaningful participation of women and girls in Afghanistan, denouncing a ban by the Taliban-led administration on women attending universities or working for any humanitarian aid groups. In a statement agreed by consensus, the 15-member council said the ban on women and girls attending high school and universities in Afghanistan represents an increasing erosion for the respect of human rights and fundamental freedoms. Foreign aid groups are suspending operations in Afghanistan following the Taliban's decision to ban women from working at international and local non-governmental organizations. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Foreign aid groups are suspending operations in Afghanistan following a decision by the Taliban to ban women from working at international and local non-government organizations. The Taliban alleges women in groups like CARE, Save the Children, and Neil Turner's Norwegian Refugee Council weren't wearing the Islamic headscarf correctly.
We have complied with all cultural norms, and we simply can't work without our dedicated female staff.
Turner says women in Afghanistan are in desperate need of assistance. Women like Amina. She says, how can we survive? My husband is sick. He can't work. I need to pay the bills, house, rent, buy medicine. Turner says the timing of this ban is very bad.
When the economy of Afghanistan is collapsing and we need women as part of the workforce to enable the economy to recover.
Women have also been banned from universities in Afghanistan. I'm Ed Donahue.
In Burkina Faso, at least 10 people were killed and 5 others were injured when a passenger bus triggered a landmine in eastern Burkina Faso on Christmas Day, the government said in a statement on Monday. The bus was traveling from the market town of Fada Ngorma, the main town in the east, about 136 miles from the capital, to a border town near neighboring Niger. The injured were taken to the hospital in Fada Ngorma, and the rest of the passengers on the bus disappeared, according to a statement by Colonel Hubert Yamiogo, the regional governor. The government is restoring security to the area and trying to locate the missing passengers, according to Yamiogo. You're listening to VOA News. Nigerian police say they are investigating an officer who shot and killed an unarmed pregnant lawyer after she left a Christmas church service. A spokesman for the Lagos City Police vowed the investigation would be swift, but critics say Nigerian authorities aren't doing enough to stop police brutality that sparked 2020 protests. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
Police in Lagos condemned the Sunday shooting and say they're holding the officer and his teammates in detention pending the outcome of the investigation. Spokesman Benjamin Hundeyin said the case is being handled by the Criminal Investigation Department for in-depth analysis. He said police will reappraise the rules of engagement to avoid future incidents. The victim, Omobolanle Rahim, was on her way home from a Christmas Day service when the officer shot at her family's vehicle at a checkpoint in Aja, killing her and her unborn child. The motive is unclear, but according to local media, the officers were conducting a stop-and-search operation. The incident has triggered widespread criticism of the police and Nigerian authorities by citizens and rights groups, including Amnesty International. On Monday, Lagos State Police authorities met with the leaders of the Nigerian Bar Association, NBA. Hussein Afolabi is a human rights lawyer.
The only reason why you have to use your firearm is if somebody is harmed. There's no reason, there's no justification for that kind of shooting. It's just unfortunate. I don't know whether they're going to do any drug test for that guy, whether he's drunk, whether he's high. What was the guy's mental state? Nobody knows.
Afolabi has been trying to help 4 families that were victims of police brutality in Oyo State, including the family of Jimo Ishiak, who was allegedly shot and killed near his house by officers during the widespread protests against police brutality in October 2020. For 2 weeks that month, activists marched in the streets calling for authorities to disband the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS, or dismiss its members from the police force. Nigerian authorities said they were disbanding the unit, but Afolabi says 2 years later, the officers are still employed.
Were they retrenched? They said they disbanded. Where are those people? They are somewhere. They are no longer SAS, but they are somewhere else. I have people who are friends who are SAS. They are still in the Nigerian police force.
NSAS protest leader Renu Odwala says the government lacks the political will to address police brutality issues.
The Nigerian government is the major perpetrator of police brutality against its own citizenry, and you can see that today. This has shown that the Lagos State government and the Nigerian government has learned nothing, and they're not willing, you know, to address the grievances of police brutality protesters.
Amnesty International says the police investigation must be impartial and made public. Many will be waiting to see how or if justice is served. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Somalia's president over the weekend said the vast majority of paid civil servants were neither in the country nor working. Hassan Sheikh Mohammed said 3,500 of 5,000 people on the government payroll appear to be so-called ghost workers. Ahmed Mohammed reports from Mogadishu, Somalia.
President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed's assertion that the most government employees do not show up for the work was condemned by Somalis. While there have been similar claims in the past, the president's statement was met with outrage and calls for action. Mahat Mahamud is fruit vendor in Mogadishu. He notes the government relies heavily on donor support to fund its budget, yet it pays people who do not report to work. Mahamud says the so-called ghost workers should be made to refund their salaries and prosecuted for corruption and abuse of public trust. Somalia's 2023 budget stands at about $960 million, more than two-thirds of it expected to come from donors. University graduate Deka Ilmi says the president and prime minister must swiftly deal with the issue of ghost workers. She says the government is paying more than 3,500 people who are not present at their offices while students who completed their education are jobless. Ilmi says the president and prime minister should urgently do something about it. President Mahamud talked about the so-called ghost workers while addressing officials during Friday prayers at the presidential mosque. Mahamud said the government's biometric time and attendance system shows the number of staff that are present. Mahamud says the machine does not lie but indicates whoever puts on their thumb on it. Civil servants are more than 5,000, he says, but only 1,500 are present. Somalia's Prime Minister Hamza Abdi Barre on Saturday confirmed the problem and ordered ministries to inspect and ensure that staff follow working hours. University of Somalia political scientist Mohamed Matan doubts that there are so many government workers not actually working. He says threats from Al-Shabaab militants who target public servants may also be keeping some away. Matan says fear of Al-Shabaab has forced everyone to trust only few and keep away from others. Although, he notes, civil servants cannot be fired and that has also led them not to be committed to work. And even if they go to the office, says Matan, they do not work. Transparency International has for the last 2 decades ranked Somalia one of the most corrupted countries in the world. Mahad Wasuge is the executive director of Somali Public Agenda, a research institution focusing on governance. He says ghost workers should be removed from public service, which should be reformed. Wasuge says that can be achieved with a broad government plan regarding the reform of the civil service, which is based on open, transparent recruitment. He says even director generals should be transparently recruited because they are not politicians but are there for administration and technical expertise. Somalia is hoping to secure debt relief from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank by the end of 2023, but it requires strict adherence to fiscal procedures, including prudent management of public resources and streamlining Somalia's public service. Ahmed Mohamed for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
In other news around the world, Ethiopian Airlines will resume flights to the capital of the war-ravaged area of northern Tigray starting tomorrow, according to an airline statement. It would be the first commercial flights to Tigray in about 18 months. The announcement comes a day after a government delegation and heads of public enterprises visited Mekelle to discuss implementing last month's peace deal. Niger has reported the highly contagious H5N1 strain of avian influenza, or bird flu, among poultry in a village in the southern part of the country. That's according to the Paris-based World Organization for Animal Health. The outbreak in the south of the Tahoe region killed most of a flock of 4,900 birds. And in eastern Congo, abductions, torture, and rapes are worsening, and scores of civilians, including women and children, have been killed by the M23 rebels in eastern Congo, according to a new UN report. What's more, the M23 rebels have forced children to be soldiers, according to the report by a UN panel of experts. The 21-page report, based on interviews with more than 230 sources and visits to Congo's North Kivu province, where the M23 have seized territory, is expected to be published later this week. Fighting has continued in eastern Congo for decades, where more than 120 armed groups are battling for control of the region. They are mostly fighting for control of land and mines with valuable minerals. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Tunisia's powerful UGTT union will hold mass protests and occupy the streets soon to show its rejection of next year's austerity budget, the leader of the union said on Monday in its strongest challenge to the government of President Kais Saied. Yet the union, with more than 1 million members, has shown its ability to paralyze the economy with strikes. It has at times backed Saied after he seized most powers last year, but on other occasions has voiced opposition. Holiday sales are up despite inflation weighing on consumers. Associated Press correspondent Rita Foley has more.
Holiday sales rose 7.6% according to MasterCard Spending Pulse, which tracks all kinds of payments, including cash and debit cards. What did Americans spend that money on? Well, sales between November 1st and December 24th, a critical period for retailers, were fueled by spending at restaurants and on clothing. Spending on jewelry and electronics was down about 5%. Online sales jumped 10.6% from a year ago. In-person spending rose 6.8%. This data is not adjusted for inflation, which has eased a little but remains painfully high. I'm Rita Foley.
To all our VOA listeners, please note you can now find International Edition back on our general website, voanews.com. There you will find other great VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voanews.com, and thanks for listening. This ends VOA's International Edition, and on behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our websites for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com and voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Chemical Weapons Convention, which entered into force in 1997, is aimed at eradicating chemical weapons from the world's arsenals. The institution that implements the treaty, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW, includes all but four of the world's states. The OPCW's governing body, the Conference of States Parties, recently concluded its 27th session in The Hague. At a press briefing on the final day, Ambassador Joseph Manzo, the U.S. permanent representative to the OPCW, underlined the treaty's achievements and its current challenges. The good news is that 99% of the world's declared chemical weapons have been destroyed. This is tens of thousands of tons of highly toxic weapons, Ambassador Manzo noted, adding that 98% of the United States' historical stockpile has been destroyed, and the U.S. remains on track to complete the destruction of its remaining stockpile in 2023. Unfortunately, a small number of countries continue to produce and employ chemical weapons, presenting a threat to all nations, said Ambassador Manzo. Syria has repeatedly used chemical weapons against its own citizens and has been stripped of the right to vote in the OPCW, and there are ongoing efforts to hold accountable those in the Assad regime responsible for the use of chemical weapons in Syria. The Russian Federation, however, continues to support the Assad regime and shield it from scrutiny and accountability. Russia itself has used chemical weapons at least twice in recent years, on former Russian intelligence agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter, and on Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Additionally, President Vladimir Putin and senior Russian officials have used irresponsible rhetoric on the potential use of weapons of mass destruction in their unjustified war against Ukraine. Ambassador Manzo pointed to President Biden's pledge that any use of chemical weapons by the Kremlin would be met with a consequential response. He also called allegations by Russian officials that Ukraine used or planned to use chemical weapons clearly part of their disinformation campaign and a disservice both to the OPCW and to all the other members. Ambassador Manzo emphasized that there is now large worldwide acceptance of the norm against the use of chemical weapons. The OPCW and the Chemical Weapons Convention, he declared, have been and remain essential to ensuring that we reach our goal of a world free of chemical weapons.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.